modeling would tell us, Andy, that it could become dominant by the end of March. That's the sobering news. The encouraging news is that the vaccines that we're currently distributing right now are quite effective against that particular variant. Less so against the South African, the 351, but hopefully we will get the virus under much better control by the time there's any indication that that might become dominant. So again, it gets back to vaccinating as many people as you possibly can and implementing the public health measures.
Dr. Anthony Fauci speaking to the Biden administration's senior COVID advisor, Andy Slavitt, during a briefing by the White House COVID response team earlier today. Fauci says the UK variant could become the dominant strain in the United States by the end of March. A report released yesterday says the UK variant of COVID-19 is doubling every 10 days here. Other worrisome variants have also been discovered here in the U.S., one from South Africa, another from Brazil. Over the weekend, officials in South Africa put the rollout of the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine on hold. And this was after a small study found that the vaccine was not effective at preventing mild or moderate COVID symptoms. Joining us with an update on the variants and vaccines is sociologist Zeynep Tufekci. She's a professor at the University of North Carolina School of Information and Library Science, and she's been writing about the pandemic for The Atlantic and The New York Times. Welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's great to have you. Well, let's talk about this UK variant now spreading like wildfire. It's here in California. It's in Florida. Do we know why it's spreading so quickly?
Well, it is more transmissible. And the early reports indicate, the scientific studies indicate, that it may have a higher viral load in the upper respiratory tract. So it's just kind of, there's more of it from where it can get out. But for practical purposes, whatever the exact mechanism will finally be nailed as, it seems to be between 30 to 50% more likely to transmit in the same kind of interaction compared to the older variant, which means, of course, as Dr. Fauci was saying, that once it's in a new place, it will quickly outcompete the old variant. Because if they think of it as a race, right? There's the old one and the new one, and the new one is faster. So it's going to infect more people. And those people now with the new variant are going to infect more people. And this is an exponential process. If you're doubling every 10 days, you know, you go from, say, 2 to 4, doesn't seem like much. 4 to 8 doesn't seem like much. And then you go from 8 to 16 and it's looking serious. And then you go from 16 to 32% in one, you know, 10-day period. So it's a very steep process once it takes off. At first, it looks very calm, but we saw this in UK, we saw this in Denmark, we saw this in Portugal, Israel, where there's better genomic surveillance. And we know it's here. We know it's doubling about every 10 days, and we don't have great surveillance, so we don't have the same kind of precise measure. So we're kind of estimating, but it is subject to our rate of vaccination, because that's the way to block it.
Right.
It is going to take over. It is going to take over here, just like everywhere else.
Right. And so the big question is, do the current vaccines, are they strong enough against this UK variant?
They are, especially the ones that we are currently using in the United States by Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna. In preliminary studies, they've already been shown to be highly effective against this variant. They're already very, very effective vaccines. They're very good at preventing almost any disease. They're excellent at preventing severe disease, or, you know, they completely eliminate hospitalization. So that's really the good news. And even if they're a little less effective against this variant, it seems to be really slight, and it doesn't seem to cause big problems. Like, you might get, say, a little bit more breakthrough clinical symptoms, a little fever, you know, sniffles, a headache, but still it's preventing the severe versions of this, which is what we care about. So that's really hopeful. Like, if we can get ahead of it with as fast a vaccination program as we possibly can, we're basically depriving this new variant of opportunities to double.
Right. So it's really, we're really in a race with this variant and the vaccines.
Yes.
And it seems like the variant at this point is winning, because here in Los Angeles, the first dose has been put on hold because there's just not enough vaccine here this week, and so that people can get their second shots.
Yeah, so that's the dilemma. We have a shortage, and we should do everything we can to increase our supply. There's been a lot of debate about, like, maybe delaying the booster a little bit. The World Health Organization and the CDC currently say it's okay to delay up to 6 weeks, but they're waiting for more data to change those guidelines. So in the end, like, whatever countries decide to do, it's going to be really important to maximize how many people we can vaccinate as fast as possible. And of course, the concern is the booster makes the vaccine even more effective, right? You start some protection, but with the booster, you get a little bit more. So it's a trade-off between coverage and how well it's going to work. And these are not easy decisions for any country.
Right. Well, one solution is the Johnson & Johnson shot, which is just one shot. Doesn't need two shots. Doesn't need the second booster.
It
Do you think that's going to be an effective
way.
Answer?
That is an excellent option, but I want to say something. Like, the current ones are great too. The Johnson & Johnson one is shown to be like 72% efficacious in preventing all disease. I'm sorry, any disease, which is great. But the Moderna and Pfizer may well be right around there with their first shot. They're just going to get even better with the booster. So the Johnson & Johnson, the advantage there is that you can do a single dose, and it's been tested over a longer period of time. So we feel more confident about what's going to happen over the long period after the single dose compared to Moderna and Pfizer, where we don't really have those sort of longer term trials yet. So it doesn't really mean it doesn't work. It just means that there are a lot of things, you know, in a fast moving pandemic that we haven't completely studied. But right now, the ones that United States has, Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson, which is up for authorization at the end of this month, are absolutely working against the UK variant. They are less effective to varying degrees. We're still learning against the South African variant, which doesn't seem to have to be very common here yet. But if we don't vaccinate fast enough, and if also we don't vaccinate the world fast enough, right, you can't solve the problem because variants keep emerging, and we're clearly going to have to do a booster. So it's really a race. Like, how fast can we vaccinate before the virus gets better at transmitting?
Well, so in the meantime, are our masking and hand washing and social distancing protocols good enough against these more contagious variants, do you think?
So clearly, since they're more transmissible, there is the idea that if you do the same thing as before, you're going to get more cases. Right. So there's a way in which you do need to be more strict. Now, it doesn't mean you need new categories of strict because it's still a respiratory virus. Right. So you're going to need to do what you're doing before. But the same thing that one got away with the old variant may well result in a transmission incident with this new one. In fact, that's exactly what it means for it to be more transmissible. So what I've been recommending to people, and that's what a lot of sort of countries are moving towards, is especially around people not of your household indoors, is to use better masks. That means a better fitting mask. If you're using a cloth mask, one with triple layers. A surgical mask, especially like level 3 or level 2 with a brace to make it fit better, because masks not only work by layers, they work with fit. So you might have a great like layered mask, but if the sides are all open, it's not doing the same thing. There are for people who are at high risk or at workplaces indoors all day, N95s or the Korean KF94s are an option to look into. So better masks will definitely help. Paying more attention to ventilation, especially as the weather gets better, because this virus is transmitted through aerosols, which can sort of float around. But if you open windows, the air kind of takes them out of the place, which is great, rather than accumulating, you know, being sort of standing away. Those 6 feet guidelines, even though they're not binary, right? You can still, if you're indoors, be at risk at 6 feet because it's going to accumulate indoors. So basically, my advice is that given the variant that's going to hit us, it really makes sense to be even more cautious, especially with better masks and ventilation be outdoors as much as possible for socializing or anything like that. Because the vaccines are going to work, right? We're at the sort of the end stage, and then we'll eventually do boosters, and that's going to work too. We just have to get through this. Yeah. The virus got the ability to sprint right towards the end, which is terrible. But we have excellent vaccines, which is the good news. We don't have enough of them, but it's looking better every day, I think. Like, we got 2 million vaccinated last on Sunday. So we just need to keep up and increase the supply and vaccinate and just be more cautious.
Okay. Well, thank you. Wise words, sociologist Zeynep Tufekci. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Zeynep Tufekci, she's a professor at the University of North Carolina School of Information and Library Science. Well, the loneliness of quarantine and lockdowns has caused a rise in alcohol consumption. A study from the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism found that liquor consumption last year was up by 19% for adults between the ages of 30 and 59. The economic conditions brought on by the pandemic have also made it harder for people struggling with sobriety. All this could be causing an increase in severe liver disease. Here to talk about that is Dr. Brian Lee. He's a hepatologist and liver transplant specialist with Keck Medicine at USC. Welcome, Dr. Lee.
Hi, it's very nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Well, tell us what you're seeing. You're seeing a rise in patients with problems with their livers and alcohol addiction?
That's right. You know, it's really been a trend that we've been seeing even before COVID, but it's been particularly pronounced with COVID. That is, people who are drinking more and come in with severe liver disease in the hospital.
What is severe liver disease? What are the symptoms?
Right. So liver disease, people think about somebody who is yellow and with a big belly and really cirrhosis, which is end-stage liver disease. But the reality is that most people with cirrhosis don't have any symptoms at all. So one, I think it's important to recognize heavy alcohol use and to speak to that with your doctors to be able to be screened for liver disease. But in the hospital, when somebody is very sick, what we see is that people come in with alcoholic hepatitis, which is severe inflammation from alcohol use, or they have decompensated cirrhosis, meaning that they've developed, you know, a fluid in the belly or infection or bleeding from their liver disease.
So if it doesn't, if most people don't have symptoms, how do you know if you have it?
It's important to be screened for it. So we have blood tests, imaging, or biopsies to be able to tell if you have liver disease.
And what is heavy drinking? What's the definition?
So the actual definition is, you know, 4 drinks per day for women and then 5 drinks per day for men. And that's the definition for heavy drinking. But what people don't know is that you can develop liver disease at much lower amounts. So they've been shown that women who drink more than 1 drink per day on average and 2 drinks per day for men can cause significant liver disease over time.
Oh, wow. Is there any safe level of alcohol consumption?
So we used to think that if you were below those thresholds, meaning, you know, 1 drink per day for women and then 2 drinks per day for men. But, you know, there's a recent, very large global study that showed that any amount of alcohol actually reduced overall survival and life expectancy. So many people would say that there isn't any safe level of alcohol consumption.
Hmm. Well, I mean, doesn't the liver regenerate itself? Can it repair itself if it's been damaged by alcohol consumption?
Yeah, exactly. So the liver is an incredible organ in that. After damage, it's able to grow back and regenerate. So people who, you know, have had heavy drinking and they develop, you know, hepatitis, if they're able to stop drinking, the liver is able to recover. Now, there comes a point, you know, particularly when you have cirrhosis, that it might be too late. So it's really important to recognize liver disease early, especially when it's from alcohol.
What are you hearing from your patients who struggle with alcohol during this pandemic? What are they saying to you?
I think that COVID has caused a lot of stress in many different ways. And we know now that stress is heavily linked to alcohol use, whether you start drinking or your drinking habits become worse. So, you know, I've heard all sorts of stories, whether it's, you know, from the stress of the virus itself or being lonely or bored at home or being divorced because of all the stress with COVID and then having that drink more, losing your job. So we've seen all sorts of different reasons to be stressed and anxious during COVID. And that's what I've been hearing time and time again from patients.
Mm. And what are you advising that they do? Are you saying you should not drink at all, or are you advising moderation? Or?
So people with liver disease, especially those who come into the hospital with liver disease due to alcohol, it's really important that, and I always say, not even a drop of alcohol ever again. Now that's easier said than done, and you know, alcohol use disorder is a disease. But really, somebody with liver disease really shouldn't be even having a drop of alcohol.
And someone who may be on the verge of it, who may be drinking too much?
That's right. So I'd say that for somebody who's healthy from a liver perspective, you know, one drink per day for women, two drinks per day for men, shouldn't really cause significant liver disease. But those who already have liver disease, not even a drop.
All right, Dr. Brian Lee, he's a hepatologist and liver transplant specialist with Keck Medicine at USC. Thanks for joining us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Coming up, the Supreme Court lets churches reopen in California. We're going to talk about that and more with our legal Jessica Levinson next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Former President Donald Trump's second impeachment trial begins tomorrow. In a brief filed this morning, his lawyers argued that Trump, quote, did not direct anyone to commit unlawful actions and that the case should be dismissed entirely because he can't be held responsible for the actions of a, quote, small group of criminals. Unsurprisingly, the House impeachment managers rejected that request. But the brief gives us more clues about the president's planned defense. It's Monday, so Jessica Levinson is here to talk about this. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Legal here on Press Play. Hi.
Happy favorite day of my week.
Oh, that's so nice. I am fine, thank you. So we have talked about this trial a lot, you and I, on the show already. So let's not spend too much time on it, but tell us more about the nuggets of information you've gleaned from this brief in terms of how they plan, his lawyers plan to defend him.
Well, I think you laid it out really well in the question, actually. I mean, I think there's two big buckets of defense. And the first is we shouldn't be even having this trial at all. It's not constitutional to have an impeachment trial for somebody who's no longer in office. You and I have talked about the many reasons why I think that doesn't hold any constitutional water, so to speak. And then the other bucket is really what you said in the question, which is basically you can't draw enough of a line between what President Trump said and then what happened, which is funny because if you look at one of the things that the House managers want to do, they want to show that video of President Trump speaking and then movement based on cell phone data of people walking in a straight line to the Capitol. So those are the two big areas of defense. The we shouldn't even be having the trial. And OK, even if we're here, you can't prove that the president caused this behavior.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I wonder if they're going to focus on the word fight, you know, kind of like what is the meaning of is. When he said, you know, you should go fight, he's probably going to say, well, I didn't mean that literally, whereas they're going to interpret it as a literal instruction, go fight.
I think that's a lot of what's going to happen. And what you're going to see is the House managers say, let's not just pick and choose what, you know, what you're pointing to, one word here or there. Let's look at the overall context of what happened. And remember, this is not a court of law, so we're not subject to the rules of evidence. They can bring in things that happened 3 months ago, 2 months ago, the president saying over and over again, the election is going to be stolen and we need to do something about it. And they're going to essentially ask, you know, they're going to ask the Senate, the jurors, to say, look, you can draw that line. There is a direct connection, not just between what was said in that particular speech, but if you look at everything surrounding it. And then I think Republicans will try and say, or the president's defense will try and say, well, okay, but let's look at this word here. And then at this other place, the president said peacefully. So they're going to, I think, try and have a much more microscopic view and say, don't look at the whole picture. Let's just take kind of parse and take a piece by piece approach.
Okay. We'll see more in the coming days, of course. I want to talk to you about this other story in the news that's related. $2.7 billion defamation lawsuit that the voting machine company Smartmatic filed against Fox News and some of the hosts. And I think we're already seeing the fallout. Lou Dobbs, his show was canceled, not a highly rated show, and advertisers had largely shunned it. So his show was canceled, and he was one of the hosts named in the suit. So first, explain the suit. It's a lot of money, $2.7 billion. How are they alleging that Fox News defamed them?
That $2.7 billion is still, luckily, a lot of money. So what they're essentially saying is that when Fox News and members of Fox News and guests on Fox News said, yes, the election was stolen, and you know who helped flip that election? Smartmatic. They were involved. Their voting machines were involved. And they created this corruption. They created this stolen election, or they helped to facilitate it. What Smartmatic is saying here is that's a false statement. You knew it was false. You said it anyway. And there was damage that happened as a result. We've lost an enormous amount of business. And so that's, it's a very long, it's a absolutely beautiful legal writing when you look at what's alleged in the suit. And there's a great line in there, you know, 2 + 2 = 4, the earth is round and this election was not stolen. I'm paraphrasing, but that's what it boils down to, which is saying you made false statements and they hurt us.
However, Dobbs, Jeanine Pirro, another host named in the suit, they're on the opinion side of Fox. And then Giuliani is named in this, Sidney Powell. They're not even on Fox News' staff. They were just guests. So does that change things?
So it does and it doesn't. What we're looking for, we're not looking at whether the person's title is opinion or reporter. What we're looking to is what they said. Did they make a statement that sounded like it was an opinion-based statement, which would not give rise to defamation? Or did they make a statement of fact, which could give rise to defamation? So the suit here is saying, look, Fox News, you had people on, you knew what they were going to say, both your employees, even if they were on the, you know, opinion side, and the guests. And so, again, we're not looking at title. We're looking at, was the statement itself a statement of fact? And that's what can give rise to liability here.
Although Fox News is a media company, so, you know, some people who might not agree with Fox News or with this whole argument that, which is a lie, that the election was stolen, are a little leery about this kind of lawsuit going forward on, you know, in terms of protecting the press and on First Amendment grounds.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we are seeing so many more defamation suits than we used to, and against the entities, against the groups that, as you say, we should be most worried about when it comes to a defamation suit. Look, we have a really strong First Amendment tradition in our country. Defamation, by definition, punishes speech. Now, on the other side, we are really at a breaking point in terms of determining where the protection for the First Amendment ends, particularly when it comes to disinformation. And it may be, depending on what happens in this case, that this is a new frontier for fighting disinformation, that it's these court suits, and it's trying to push private companies like Twitter to shut down accounts, that it's not legislation, it's not regulation, it's asking judges to say this falls within defamation. And so this really, I think, is a big bellwether case.
Interesting. Okay, well, let's talk about the Supreme Court partially striking down California's restrictions on indoor religious services. And the justices were split on this, but they let indoor services go forward with a 25% restriction. People aren't allowed to sing or chant. And there was a lot of debate over that within the conservative wing of the court. Tell us about that really quickly.
So really quickly, there are 9 justices. There are 5 different opinions. And what you saw from the conservative side is either churches will give you everything you want, meaning none of these 3 restrictions are okay, or churches, you know what, you can have people inside, but you need to go through certain measures, the capacity limit and the limit on singing and chanting. And that middle ground ultimately is what won the day. Really interesting to see, though, on the spectrum of the conservative justices where everybody came out. Really interesting to see Justice Amy Coney Barrett's first written and signed opinion, where she does actually tread somewhat in the conservative spectrum, a middle scale, a middle approach.
Right. And she is a conservative Catholic. So one would have thought she would have sided more with the conservatives on this fully.
Well, she certainly left the door open to do so. So this was hardly a moderate opinion, I would say. But she did say, look, you have to prove it. She said, I'm waiting for more evidence. If you treat churches in a more burdensome way than you treat secular institutions, this is not OK. So her quote unquote middle ground was just, I want to see more before I make a decision.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Legal Eagle. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, France's entry to the Oscars is a love story between 2 older women.
It is important to show that there is a life and love, you know, when we are not young and beautiful anymore.
The actress Barbara Sacova, who plays one of the women, is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A new French film called Two of Us tells the story of 2 older women, Nina and Madeline, who live in France and are in love. They each have apartments on the same floor, which they plan to sell so they can move to Rome and live together freely. But Madeline can't bring herself to tell her adult children about her relationship. And when Nina discovers her betrayal, well, she's furious with Madeline and storms off in a rage. Before they can make up, Madeline suffers a debilitating stroke, and she can no longer speak. Her children sweep in to take care of her, and Nina has to pretend she is just a friendly neighbor. Two of Us is France's entry for the Oscars this year. It was nominated for a Golden Globe. Legendary German actress Barbara Sacova plays Nina in Two of Us, and her breakout role was in Fassbinder's Berlin Alexanderplatz. You may remember her from that. And Barbara Sacova joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, let's talk more about your character, Nina, and tell us more about her and her relationship with Madeline.
Nina is German, and she was a tour guide. We don't know much more about her. And she lives now with Madeleine in this small French town in the south of France. Yeah, she pretends to be the neighbor of Madeleine, but she's actually her lover.
Mm. And the two are deeply in love. It seems like it's a fresh new love because, you know, they're very amorous. But they have been in love for a very long time.
Yeah. Well, that's, I've asked myself what kept this love so fresh. Maybe it was their secrecy because they had to hide their love. And I've asked myself often, how did they even live this love? I mean, they must have met secretly because Madeleine has family. She has children. Her husband died recently. So she had a husband, a son, and a daughter, and still she managed to live that secret love with Nina.
Mm. Right. And so I guess I'm wondering why, because it's set in the present, mm-hmm. it is so difficult for them to live openly there. in their town in the south of France and to tell everyone about their relationship?
Well, because a little town in south of France is still very different from New York, London, Paris, Berlin. I think this story could not have worked well in one of the big cities. Although it might have worked, you know, in terms of their neighbors or other people, but it's always a difference with a relation with your kids. We have heard of people who, you know, young people who are very tolerant, you know, to homosexuality, to everything, to transgenderness, to everything. But when they heard that one of their parents was homosexual, it was a totally different story. So I think we judge our parents or see our parents different than we see other people. So I think that is why that secrecy and that relation is lived the way you see it in the film.
Right. And so that frustrates your character, Nina, who doesn't have children and who doesn't feel constrained, perhaps because she's not French, she's German, living in this little town. Does she have empathy for Madeline's difficulty in expressing herself to her children and to her community?
I think she had it for a long time because, I mean, this relation has been going on for almost 30 years. But when the film starts, I think at that point, when the husband had died, she is a bit at the end of her rope. I mean, she really feels this is the moment that is for them. Now is the time when they can finally live their dream, to go to Rome, to live it openly, to have an apartment together openly, to have friends, to do things that couples do. So it's at this crucial point where Nina thinks this is going to happen now, when it's not happening.
You know, you don't often see a portrayal of a same-sex relationship between two older people on screen. There are plenty portrayals of younger people in their prime. Mm-hmm. I want you to talk about that, about how you portray this relationship as an aging woman.
Well, for me, that was the draw for me to do this role because the director is a young director. It's his first feature film, and it's always a risk, you know, to work with somebody whose work you haven't seen. He made it very clear that he wanted to have two women where you can see also the age. And he felt that our world is very much dominated by youth and beauty. And he thought that was not right, and he wanted to show an alternative. And in fact, I've actually never seen really a film with two older women having a love story and a passionate love story. And I think it is important to show that there is a life and love, you know, when we are not young and beautiful anymore. And I think the younger director was very courageous because it took him a long time to finance the film. And he could have financed it much earlier if he had taken two young, hot, sexy actresses. But he really wanted to have two older women. And I think that's the interesting thing about this film also.
Mm. Right. And also the interesting thing is that for the second half of the movie, Madeline doesn't speak. And so the two of you have to communicate just through your eyes and gestures.
I have been asked, you know, often, was it difficult for you? And it really wasn't, because I think if people have lived together or have been together for a long time, there is a communication also that is without words. You know, it's like you finish each other's sentences, or you know what the other person is going to say. You know expressions in the face. You know when the person looks like that, the person is angry or sad or withdraws. And I think they are so in tune with each other that I never felt that as a big obstacle, that she couldn't speak. At certain moments, yes, but it was not an obstacle for the acting. And Martine Chevalier, who plays Madeleine, she's a theater actress. And I think as a theater actress, I come from the theater too. One of the things you really have to know is how to project, and how to project sometimes very quiet and very small things to a big house, to a big theater. And it demands a certain inner force, and she definitely has that, and I had no difficulty reading anything in her eyes.
How did this young director, as you say, this is his first film, how did he direct you in these scenes?
I think he had a very clear idea of what he wanted to do, But at the same time, he left a lot of space for us. So I couldn't even tell you exactly what he did. We talked before the film, of course. He was very attentive, listened very carefully, and he gave us room, but still guiding us. I think he's very good. I think I'm really curious of his next work because I think he's very talented.
Yeah, right. And that it is France's entry to the Oscars is like, that's a big deal for a first-time director.
That was a total surprise for all of us. I mean, nobody had expected that. And that's really wonderful. It's a wonderful surprise, and I'm really happy for him. I wish it wouldn't have had to be in this COVID time. I wish he could have gone, you know, to the different festivals and events, because that's nice, you know, for a young artist.
Well, let's talk about your work with another director, the considerably more famous, perhaps infamous, German filmmaker Fassbinder. He was, you know, a powerhouse when it came to output, I think more than 40 movies before he died at the age of 37. He was so young. What was it like working with him? You were how old when you were on Berlin Alexanderplatz?
I was 20. I started when I was 29. Because I got my first child when I was 28. And I had said to myself, I want to stop 1 year working, and then exactly after 1 year, a day after his first birthday, I started shooting. So that was great. I mean, I loved working with him. It was great.
Right. I mean, famously exacting, famously, you know, it's been talked about how cruel he could be on set. Did you see that?
I saw that he was never, was it with me? And at one point when I had just started working with him, I tried to intervene when he was cruel with one actress. But I realized later that he did whatever he felt the actor needed to deliver his best. And I actually did talk to the actress later. And she said, no, I'm used to this and it's okay for me. He pushes me. I don't need that kind of pushing. I kind of push myself enough, I guess. So he was never that way with me. And he also worked very, very quickly, extremely quickly. He had the movie in his head completely. So there was not a lot of this, you know, you have a lot of material and in the end you put it together in different ways, you know, a lot of editing changes. We sometimes shot a day and the next day we saw the cut already put together. And so he shot to cut, and he usually did only one take, never more. And that created an atmosphere of great concentration on set, that everybody knew you have only that one chance. And so everybody gave, you know, their best.
Wow, that is really an intense working situation.
Yeah.
Do you think this was one of your first roles, right, on screen? You had been a theater actor before.
Yeah.
And did you think like all film directors were like this? Like this is what all sets are like?
Yeah. In the beginning, I had done one small film with a young director. It was a very, very low budget, very small film before. But that was all. Yeah. Of course, I kind of thought that's how you do it. And it was okay with me. I liked it very much. I like it very much.
You liked that working like that?
Yeah, I like it because you see, it's not film is not like theater. In theater, you have weeks and weeks to build a character, right? You can really change from who you are, and you research and you work and you learn your lines and you know how the play ends and you have a lot of time to build your character, especially in Germany, where we had long, you know, the theaters had a lot of money. They were all subsidized by the states. So we had 2 months, 3 months to do a play. In Eastern Germany, it was sometimes 8 months. And, but in film, if you do 5 takes or 10 takes, I think it's often not better than the first one. Either for me, it's either you have a lot of takes or you just try to do it right away. So yeah. I like that kind of work.
So we hear a lot about how older women can't get roles in movies or on TV much. Are you seeing a shift in that at all? Are there more opportunities for older actresses?
Probably with the TV series, right? There you see more older women. Like you see more diversity, you see more different ethnic groups. I have always thought, you know, film, these, you know, 2 hours that you sit in a dark movie theater, the stories that are told, this drama is so much linked also to the age where the most drama happens, kind of between 20 and 45 or so, you know, when the big love stories happen, when people get children, when, you know, when people start a career, build a business. Often, you know, at the age of 60, people are a little more settled, and maybe that doesn't generate much drama. So that's why I thought maybe there is not, you know, so much room for these roles. But it seems right now where women also play more roles in professions that were before usually cast by actors, like they play surgeons and politicians and CEOs. So there is more chance, I think, for women. So it reflects more our reality.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today. It was great talking with you.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's actor Barbara Sacova. She stars in the new French film, Two of Us. It's France's entry for international feature film at the Oscars this year, and you can watch the film now on video on demand. Coming up off the field, the NFL tried to give a racial healing message at the Super Bowl. We'll have an assessment next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, yesterday's Super Bowl marked a lot of firsts. Of course, it was the first to be played in a global pandemic. It was also the first Super Bowl to feature a female referee, Sarah Thomas, and the first Super Bowl to include poetry. The poet who electrified President Biden's inauguration, Amanda Gorman, read her poem Chorus of the Captains during the pregame.
Let us walk with these warriors, charge on with these champions, and carry forth the call of our captains. We celebrate them by acting with courage and compassion, by doing what is right and just. For while we honor them today, it is they who every day honor us.
Well, Gorman is Black, as are a lot of the performers during the pregame and halftime show, and of course, many of the players. But the NFL's record on racial equality has been lacking. Until recently, the league did not allow players to silently protest police brutality. They couldn't kneel during the anthem. So it was conspicuous that there were a lot of racial justice messages at the Super Bowl this year. Players sporting the names of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd on their helmets in NFL spots. One spot pledged $250 million to help end systemic racism. Here to talk about all this is Jay Connor. He's staff writer at The Root and co-host of the Extraordinary Negroes podcast. Welcome back to Press Play, Jay.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you back. Do you always watch the Super Bowl? Is it something you look forward to?
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely something that I usually take part in. Although I think this year the stakes were a little bit different just because for a few years I actually boycotted the NFL in light of, you know, the Colin Kaepernick situation. But I think this year specifically, coming off the heels of, you know, George Floyd and the racial reckoning that our country undertook, you know, the NFL made some steps to try to address the situation. And I think it was a little bit more interesting this year in regards to how they went about it.
Right. And so you had people like the veteran sportscaster James Brown saying this during the pregame coverage.
To do the right thing is to recognize that people are given gifts and talents wrapped in a wide array of packaging, light colored and dark colored, male and female, everyone. If that truth is embraced and acted upon, then fairness, justice, and equality of opportunity will be the byproducts. And most of all, divisiveness does not have to continue. If we choose, unconditional love for people really matters. Because love never, ever fails.
Okay, so that came after CBS aired a video narrated by Viola Davis about the NFL's history with the players of color. What do you make of all this, this very overt display of attempts at racial reckoning and racial healing?
I think that, you know, I think there's definitely a certain level of pandering going on. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I mean, throughout the course of the season, we saw the NFL play the Black National Anthem. They were putting messaging on helmets. They were putting stencils on the field with Black Lives Matter. And then I believe it was in June that the NFL announced that it was spending $250 million over the course of the next 10 years to combat systemic racism and social injustice. But it's also curious that, you know, the league is taking these steps only after the death of George Floyd and in light of what already happened with Colin Kaepernick. So it's like, how can you treat Kaepernick in the way that you did, but also say that, like, he inspired change and he inspired these whole campaigns? Like, it doesn't make sense. And it's also important to note that, you know, Roger Goodell came forward and said, you know, Black Lives Matter, and I wish you would have went about this differently. But the NFL can't, you know, assert that Black Lives Matter while also making donations to, you know, Republican PACs. You know what I'm saying? Especially mm-hmm. when, you know, Republican candidates have notoriously been one of the biggest adversaries of the movement for Black lives. So it just sounds like they're just trying to have their cake and eat it too. And I mean, there's a lot of things that a lot of people aren't necessarily privy to that are still ongoing, as far as, you know, the discrimination allegations concerning to the league's concussion settlement program. And I mean, we just had a hiring cycle where, you know, two of the last 20 Black, you know, two of the last 20 coaches in the entire NFL are Black. You know what I'm saying? We just literally saw one of the most well-qualified coaches, Eric Bieniemy, not get a job. So, I mean, they still have a lot to do in regards to addressing these situations. And it's not lost to a lot of us at all.
Okay, let's talk about the national anthem. So R&B singer Jasmine Sullivan sang alongside country musician Eric Church. And here's a little bit of that. All right, Jay, what did you make of that? Another obvious attempt to, you know, portray unity, portray Black, white coming togetherness.
Well, first and foremost, Jasmine Sullivan can do no wrong. She is one of the greatest voices of our generation, and her voice is probably the cure for COVID-19. But as far as the, you know, the racial reconciliation national anthem thing that they had going on, it didn't sit well with me, particularly because of the ongoing controversy surrounding Morgan Wallen. In regards to him being found on tape, or, you know, being the footage of it coming out of him, you know, spewing the N-word. And to me, it's just interesting that they specifically sought out an R&B artist and a country artist to kind of do this. And the timing is just horrible.
Although it is one guy, and Eric Church isn't accused of doing that, the guy who was singing with.
No. Sullivan. But that was the first thing that came to mind when I saw that.
So you thought it was awkward and weird?
Yeah, I just thought the timing of it, just with that literally happening earlier this week, and that's not to say that mm-hmm. they didn't already have this set up months in advance. It's just the timing was just terrible.
Okay, what about the halftime performance, The Weeknd? What'd you think?
I think The Weeknd, I don't think he was necessarily a good selection for this, as evidenced by my own opinion and that of, you know, the rest of social media. But I mean, I think that, like, visually it was cool. It was cool to look at. But the performance itself, if you got rid of the lights and all the dancing and everything, like, the performance itself, to me, it left a lot to be desired. It felt like he was pretending to be lost in a plastic surgeon's office. Like, I didn't quite understand, like, what he was trying to do.
I literally got dizzy in that Hall of Mirrors situation.
You know, but also I think, too, that he's exactly what they were looking for. You know what I mean? In regards to finding somebody who's going to be a safe pick, who's not going to be, you know, too risque or not going to be too political. Somebody who's just going to be to go out there, perform, and just so happens to be Black while, you know, the NFL is on his kick. So, I mean, he checked every box, but unfortunately, he left the last one unchecked as far as, you know, providing a good performance. And you couldn't hear him.
Wow. Jay, you are harsh. You are taking no prisoners today.
Could you hear him when he was performing?
No, not really.
Yeah. See that too.
Yeah. I wasn't into it, I have to say. He's no J-Lo. He's no Beyonce.
You're right.
Well, maybe next year.
I was about to say, there's always next year, so we'll see what happens next year.
Okay. Jay Connor, writer at The Root and co-host of the Extraordinary Negroes podcast. Thank you, Jay.
Thank you for having me.
All right. That will do it for us today. Thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brandon. I'll see you tomorrow.